I'm John Strum, and this is Real Talk MS. It's May 11th, and we have a lot to talk about. As I look around, it's clear that we're entering a new phase of the COVID-19 pandemic. With some glaring exceptions, India certainly comes to mind, the world is starting to emerge from the worst days of COVID-19, and as people are getting vaccinated, we're stepping back into all those parts of our lives that were unexpectedly and abruptly put on hold. But we're not stepping out unscathed. The pandemic has taken an unprecedented emotional toll. We're witnessing spikes in depression and anxiety. And for a lot of people living with MS, their anxiety may have transitioned from worrying about how COVID-19 will interact with MS to worrying about how COVID-19 vaccines will interact with MS disease-modifying therapies. That's an awfully long time to carry around a lot of worry. Joining me to talk about managing moods and quieting some of the noise in our heads is psychologist, psychoanalyst, certified multiple sclerosis specialist, and MS partner in care, Dr. Gail Lewis. But before we get to my conversation with Dr. Lewis, there are a few other things that you should know about. iConquer MS, the people-powered MS research network, is investigating COVID-19 vaccines and how they work in people affected by MS. So they've launched a study called the COVID-19 Vaccine Response in MS Project, or COVER-MS, to learn more about the real-world experiences of people with MS who've received these vaccines. After collecting almost 1,000 survey responses, iConquer MS has issued some initial findings about vaccine side effects that were reported by the survey participants. So out of 930 survey responses, 607 respondents had already received at least a single dose of a COVID-19 vaccine. Almost all of these 607 respondents received either the Pfizer or Moderna vaccine. And of those 607 participants, 339 had already received their second dose of the vaccine. When it comes to side effects, 60% of the 607 participants experienced some side effects after receiving their first vaccine dose, and 71% of the 339 study participants who had already received their second dose also reported experiencing side effects after the second dose. The majority of the reported side effects included pain at the injection site, fatigue, and headache. In other words, these are the same sorts of mild to moderate side effects that everyone could experience after being vaccinated, whether they have MS or not. And that underscores the vaccination guidance that's been issued by the National MS Society and the MS International Federation, advising people with MS to get vaccinated as early as they can. I guess when you compare these very minor sorts of side effects with the potential impact of getting COVID-19, especially if your MS-related disabilities or other illnesses are more pronounced, it just makes more and more sense to be vaccinated as soon as possible. We can expect to see further results from the COVER-MS study as more data comes in. But if you'd like to review the initial findings from the study, I'll include a link in today's show notes. And I'll also invite you to be a participant in this study, as it is still ongoing. So if you have just a few minutes, please visit iConquerMS.org, participate in the COVER-MS study, and be a part of MS research. While we're talking about iConquerMS, I want to tell you about a new survey that they've just launched, and it's for MS care partners. So if that's not you, perhaps you know one, and you can tell them about this. We already know how important it is to involve people living with MS in all the different aspects of clinical trials. Patient-focused drug development means that people living with MS can function not only as participants, but also in the planning, recruitment, and reporting phases of a clinical trial. But what about their care partners? Because of their proximity to the disease, care partners see MS through a slightly different lens, and sharing that perspective could add further value to a clinical trial. So this very short survey, it'll take you less than 5 minutes to complete, is designed to measure MS care partners' awareness of patient-focused drug development and their interest in participating in it. Better clinical trials mean better outcomes, and better outcomes mean better MS treatments. So if you're a care partner, or you know a care partner with 5 minutes to invest in making clinical trials better, you'll find a link to this survey in today's show notes. As I said just a moment ago, better clinical trials mean better outcomes. So I want to tell you about a better clinical trial for progressive MS. The trial is called Octopus. This world's first mega trial for progressive MS got its name Octopus because this trial has multiple arms. Let me explain what that means. In this trial, researchers will be testing several drugs at the same time against one placebo arm. And the trial combines what would traditionally be two consecutive clinical trial phases into one. The interim analysis of MRI scans from each trial participant will allow the research team to move forward to the next stage in the trial much quicker. If MRI scans show a particular treatment is slowing the rate of brain shrinkage, the research team can assume that it will eventually slow disability worsening, and that particular treatment can be further investigated with hundreds of participants. And any treatments not showing potential in the MRI scan will be dropped from the study so that researchers aren't wasting time and resources on treatments that are unlikely to be successful. This flexible trial design means that if scientists discover another treatment in the laboratory, that new treatment can be slotted into the Octopus study without having to wait years to set up a whole new clinical trial. Octopus has the potential to make MS clinical trials more efficient, and that means that better treatments get developed, tested, and approved faster. Octopus will be launching later this year in the United Kingdom. We'll be sure to keep you updated on which treatments are going to be initially tested once that announcement is made. Octopus represents, in every sense of the word, a game-changing approach to MS clinical trials. And you can be sure that we'll be talking more about Octopus as the study progresses. Every month, CanDo MS offers great programs for people living with MS and their care partners. May is Mental Health Awareness Month, and this month's CanDo MS programs are designed to help manage your state of mind. On May 12th, you can participate in a coaching session on managing your emotions. On May 20th, there's a jumpstart program called State of Mind, Coping with Changes in Your Thinking. And on May 25th, there's one more coaching session on adapting to changing cognition. All of the CanDo MS programs are available to you at no charge, and you can participate from the comfort and safety of your own home. If you'd like to learn more and sign up for these upcoming workshops and coaching sessions, you can visit CanDo-MS.org/programs, and you'll find that link in today's show notes. And speaking of managing your state of mind, living through a lockdown while witnessing a death toll in numbers that no one could have ever imagined has, to some degree or another, affected everyone. Experts are saying that the COVID-19 pandemic has created a worldwide mental health crisis of a size and scope that's never before been experienced. My guest today is Dr. Gail Lewis. Dr. Lewis is a psychologist and psychoanalyst who is also a certified multiple sclerosis specialist and an MS partner in care. In a moment, we'll talk with Dr. Lewis about reconnecting with our inner well-being. Dr. Gail Lewis is a psychologist and psychoanalyst currently in private practice in New York City. She's also a certified multiple sclerosis specialist and an MS partner in care through the National MS Society. And Dr. Lewis is a board-certified telebehavioral health specialist. In fact, Dr. Lewis has recently launched a telehealth extension of her private practice that's focused on serving people affected by MS, and we'll talk more about this aspect of her practice in just a moment. But first, welcome to the podcast, Dr. Lewis.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
This must be an interesting time to be a mental health professional. Many people across the United States are just beginning to safely leave their homes and start re-engaging with the world. There's been a tremendous focus on how a year of relative isolation has impacted our emotional well-being. What are you and your colleagues learning about our collective mental and emotional health status?
Well, I think in general, we can say that isolation can be protracted isolation can be very detrimental to one's psychological and mental well-being. Studies have shown that the outcomes of prolonged isolation can include increased depression, poor sleep quality, impaired executive function, which of course, when we're concerned with people who have MS, that can be of additional worry. Also, accelerated cognitive decline has been known to be an issue with protracted isolation. So there are a lot of conversations that have been taking place as to how we help these people who are isolated because of their isolation also might not feel as motivated to reach out for help, and how we can perhaps encourage them to do so that some of these concerns do not become overly problematic.
Well, I think as you've just pointed out, the pandemic has had a profound effect on everyone's lives, and that certainly includes people living with MS. If we can drill down a little bit to my last question, what have you observed about the mental health status of people who are affected by multiple sclerosis?
What I have noticed is that whatever mobility they might have had prior to the pandemic has been marginalized so severely that while having MS in and of itself might have made them feel trapped by their bodies, they now additionally feel trapped by the effects of the pandemic because of what is considered to be safe, what is considered to be dangerous. And I'm finding increased levels of depression, increased levels of anxiety, increased physical problems as a result of not moving. Even if the mobility was focused on being able to walk down the block, that has considered not to be a safe thing for many people because of fear of what they're going to find outside of their homes, outside of their safe place. But their safe place can also become, and has become for many, very problematic for them because they can't physically move.
You know, in the MS community, it seems as though we're shifting from people experiencing anxiety over how COVID-19 might affect them to experiencing anxiety over how the COVID-19 vaccine might affect them. That's a lot of anxiety over a long period of time. What are the residual effects of carrying around that kind of anxiety for months and for some people for the past year?
Well, I can just, let me answer initially in terms of MS and anxiety. Anxiety for people who have MS and for their support partners largely goes unaddressed. It's not something that typically gets asked about when one is visiting a neurologist, just due to time constraints, not because of a neurologist's lack of capacity to ask the question. And people don't necessarily talk about their levels of anxiety. A lot of people feel ashamed that they feel anxious. A lot of people feel that they shouldn't feel anxious. And I think the growing amount of anxiety that has come due to the past year's pandemic, and because of what does it mean to have to live in a world in which there is COVID? What are my risks in contracting COVID? What are my risks as a support partner in going outside and doing the things that I need to do for both myself and for my MS person? What kinds of risks am I bringing into the home by doing that? That also creates a higher level of anxiety. So how does one then deal with, we have a vaccine that has emerged, several vaccines that have emerged that have been seen to be very effective. We're being told that they are effective. We're being told that everyone should get a vaccine. But it means re-entering the world in which we have been told has been dangerous. And it means re-entering a world in which we are having then to interact with people who have been dangerous to us, just by virtue of the fact that COVID is dangerous, and therefore it has made people seem dangerous to each other. So it's a matter of dealing with what does it mean to re-socialize, even if it's in the case of re-socializing to get a vaccine, and dealing with the anxiety of that, and whether or not we feel that this vaccine is going to actually take care of us, and is it safe to take? It was conceived so rapidly, and therefore that for many people that conveys some kind of, you know, level of questionability. Is it to be trusted? Are there any side effects for someone like a person who has MS? Are there any concerns about what it means for someone who has a compromised immune system due to the medication they're taking, and whether or not they should stop taking their DMTs? Should they continue taking their DMTs? Should they continue doing whatever kind of therapies they have been doing to try to take care of their MS? That has been a very big concern for people who have MS, both whether or not I am more at risk of getting COVID, and whether or not my immunocompromising medications put me at greater risk of either getting COVID or contracting a more severe case of it. And will the vaccine in any way impede the effectiveness of my DMTs?
Well, I think the good news there is that if we turn to science rather than some of the opinion masquerading as fact that we find in social media often, I think if we turn to science, we get answers to lots of those questions. You know, talking about the safety of the vaccine at this point, I think overlooks the reality that literally hundreds of millions of people have been vaccinated. And if there were significant risk or concern, I don't think it would be kept secret for very long. So I think that we can look to reliable data. We can look to reliable guidance. Virtually every MS society in the world, as well as the MS International Federation, has posted pretty detailed guidance, all recommending that people living with MS receive the vaccine, because we don't restart life. We don't get past all the obstacles you've just mentioned, those emotional burdens that people carry as a result of isolation, until we're vaccinated. And so I think that the good news here is that there's detailed guidance, not only about getting a vaccination, but how it's going to interact with every single disease-modifying therapy that's available today. And we're learning more and more every day. So that's the good news in terms of objective fact. But as individuals, what do people need to do to get past some of those fears that have existed and grown over time as they've been home and out of the world for the past year? How do people begin to redevelop the will and desire to reengage with that outside world that we each say we miss so much?
I think that's an excellent question. And one that people even apart from the MS world are struggling with these days, how to reengage in living in a way that feels natural, in a way that feels safe, in a way that feels flexible, because so many of those aspects of living that have seemed normal are no longer normal. And even if we talk about returning to a state of normalcy due to having excellent vaccines and lots of science behind it, and you are absolutely right, the MS Society and all of the MS organizations have been incredibly valuable in putting up information on their various sites and communicating as best as they can to the population that getting the vaccine is safe and doing it in ways that are safe and in accordance with whatever kinds of treatments they're getting. I don't think that it's about getting past the fear. I think it's about moving through it. I think it's about owning the fear, acknowledging that you have it, respecting why you have it, and finding your way through it. I often tell patients that it can be helpful to act as if you feel okay. Act as if you feel safe. Act as if you feel that doing this will not be dangerous. Because sometimes acting as if, it doesn't ignore the fear, for example, but it allows you to project yourself into a space that perhaps sitting in a soup of fear might not allow you to do so. So acting as if stepping outside your home and being outside in the world, something that many people have not been doing this past year, acting as if that might feel like a good thing to do, can actually make it something that feels good to do.
You know, when I'm speaking to groups or speaking on the podcast, I always try to remind people that MS doesn't only affect individuals, it affects families. And even before the pandemic, MS family caregivers may have already been experiencing significant levels of stress and anxiety that just go along with the role of being a caregiver. Yes. I imagine that the pandemic didn't improve things. So have you observed how MS caregivers have been emotionally impacted by the COVID-19 pandemic?
I have. And I think that, first of all, I think that generally speaking, support partners, caregivers, I think support partners is a more global way of describing what an MS person's person is for them, because it's not just about giving care, it's about supporting their lives and, you know, the different aspects of their lives. And I think support partners generally are not given enough credit and enough attention to the enormity of what they have to do, they volunteer to do, they want to do. They're put in a position where for some people they don't have a choice, but this is what they do. And support partners have a lot of feelings about that, and a lot of feelings that they feel ashamed about having, such as, I shouldn't feel anxious. I shouldn't feel like my wants matter, because my MS person's wants matter more. And my paying attention to my MS person's needs matter more than my needs. And so I think in general, there's a lack of attention paid to what a support partner needs and in terms of support for themselves and in terms of a space for themselves to be able to vent and to be able to feel like what they're feeling is okay and what they're feeling is normal and valid and that their feelings should be respected. And I think one of the biggest difficulties that I'm noticing, what I have noticed during this time, is that with COVID, there have been so many limitations due to the danger of COVID. So many, many support partners who have been able to go out to their work setting, which for them has been a source of income, a source of financial support for the family, also a space maker between them and their MS person, as long as it's been safe to do that, where they can thrive, where they can do what they need to do, where they can maybe not focus so much on the MS, that having that space because of COVID for many people has been taken away from them because workspaces were mandated to close down. They were not considered to be safe because there'd be too many people around. And therefore, support people were forced to work from home. So that space that their work granted them was no longer there for them. So then how do you negotiate that? How do you negotiate being able to have that space and also negotiate your MS person now being there all the time with you? And how do you separate what you need to do for your well-being as someone who's earning a living, for your well-being as someone who identifies in your profession? Self-identity is very big. It's a big issue when it comes to when someone is in a particular career. This is what I do. This is who I am. So how does one retain that and negotiate that when they're right next to their MS person who is also knows they're right there and they need help? How do they make that distinction? How do they make those boundaries? How do they create that space? How do the two of them make agreements about how to negotiate that space? And I'm finding that there have been a lot of arguments. There have been increased levels of stress, increased levels of loneliness for both parties. And I think loneliness when you're with someone can, in fact, feel more painful than loneliness when you're by yourself. So I think that has become very difficult, that expectations of one another when you're in that space together needs to be renegotiated. And I've found that they really haven't been, that there's a lot of fumbling around how to manage this forced space together due to what the pandemic has imposed upon us.
And in the midst of that forced togetherness, that escalating stress level that the care partner may be experiencing, that ultimately can have a negative impact on the quality of care that they're providing to that loved one. And that becomes a real danger, because now we have a patient and a care partner who both need caring for.
Very much so. And I think that because in my experience, there are people who have a great deal of pride, care partners in particular, male care partners in particular, have a great deal of pride in being able to take on what they've agreed to take on and to do it on their own and to not ask for help, that it's a pride injury to ask for help if it's from their person who they are caring for, or if it's from someone external to their immediate vicinity. So in the lack of feeling comfortable and feeling safe and feeling as if it's okay to ask for help from each other, the danger in that is that needs are not being met for both people, that necessary engagements with each other are being avoided that there is more separation, even though they, you know, physically they're closer together, there can be more separation. There could be increased arguing. There is a risk. There is a risk of abuse. I think overall that when people are so confined with each other and there is such increased stress levels, and when people are not finding safety and finding other outlets or finding support or asking for support, there are increased chances of abuse occurring, whether it be emotional abuse, mental abuse, physical abuse. And it's this whole situation that we have all been dealing with in the past year. Overall, there have been increases in abuse occurring in homes. And it can be a particular risk with someone who has an immobility due to a chronic disease such as MS.
You know, when I introduced you, I mentioned that you've launched a telehealth extension of your practice. So tell me about the telebehavioral services that you offer to people affected by MS.
This particular branch of my practice is, when I started it, it was particular to working with an area of the MS population that I felt was not being taken care of in a way that I feel needed to be taken care of. And, you know, maybe that is not for me to say, but I'm saying it. So there, I'm saying it. And the population I'm talking about are people who have MS who are non-ambulatory, who could possibly have difficulties in being able to get to a psychologist's office, and people with MS who live in rural areas for whom psychological services are not readily available. I came up with this idea prior to the pandemic. So my goal was to offer telebehavioral services to that population, whether it be via a video platform, if that was available, because I do realize that for many people, particularly those living in a rural area, this kind of platform isn't available, or by phone. And so my aim was to find better ways to make accessible the kind of services and support that I offer, not just to the person who has MS, but to the support group, if it's a group around that person, which is something I already do in my practice. I've always done in my practice. I've always included the support people to come in with the person who has MS, to come in alone, just to be able to have a space that's theirs where they can talk and they can vent and they can feel validated and they can feel the freedom to be able to talk about their experience without feeling judged, without being shamed for what they feel. So this is why I launched this aspect of my practice, because I wanted to reach more people whom I think could benefit from being able to have someone to talk to.
So how can people find out more about your practice and perhaps even get in touch with you to take advantage of it?
There are a couple of ways to do that. I have a new website, and it has a long name to it. It's www.mstelletherapy.com. And on that website, you'll find ways to contact me. I have an email address on there. I have an office phone number. There's also a page on there where you can just click onto a link asking to contact me and asking to have a phone consultation with me. There's lots of information on there about the services that I offer. And I want to emphasize that one of the things that has been most important to me about doing this, not just about reaching a particular population, but recognizing that this particular population would probably be in need of services that do not cost a lot of money. That's why therapy can be so out of reach for so many people, because of the cost of it. It saddens me that it's considered a luxury. Particularly these days, it should not be considered a luxury. It should be considered something that is so easily available to people. And I wanted to make what I offer as easily available as possible. And I want to emphasize, I do so by making my fees very low. For me, this is not a money-making venture for my practice. This is about making my services accessible. So I explain all of that on my website, and I'm emphasizing that now, that I want you to hear in my voice that I want to be of help. So I want to do whatever I can to make what I'm offering as accessible as possible. And I want people listening to really know that and to hear that in my voice. If there's any fear in reaching out to me feeling that, oh, I can't afford this, it's too much money, it's not something that I'd be able to manage, it would just be too much, too costly for me, please, please try not to let that stop you from reaching out to me, because I want to make it possible. And that's why I'm doing this.
Well, Dr. Gail Lewis, thank you for all you do to improve the well-being and quality of life for people affected by MS. And thanks for talking with me today.
It's been my absolute pleasure. Thank you again for the opportunity. I appreciate so much what you do for the MS community, as I'm sure so many do. And I'm so glad to be part of this program. So thank you.
That's going to wrap up this episode of Real Talk MS. Real Talk MS is powered by the National MS Society. And you can share this episode of the podcast by letting your friends or family members know that all they have to do is point their web browser at realtalkms.com/193. You'll find that link in today's show notes, so you can easily copy and paste it right into an email or a text. And now I have a favor to ask. It would mean a lot to me if you'd leave a rating and review for Real Talk MS. Just point your web browser at realtalkms.com/review, and you'll see links to the different online destinations that you can choose from to leave that rating and review. Now, these links are going to be different for each of you because they're based upon the software that you happen to be using to listen to podcasts. For instance, if you happen to be using an Android phone to listen to Real Talk MS, you won't see a link to leave a rating and review on Apple Podcasts, because you can't leave a rating or review on Apple Podcasts with an Android phone. I hope that makes sense. It's just a little bit of technology that makes leaving a rating and review super easy. So I hope you'll take a moment to leave a rating and review for Real Talk MS. And you'll find a link to do that in today's show notes. I'm John Strum. Thanks for listening. Stay safe and make healthy choices.